Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you've been house hunting recently, you know the process has become a bit frustrating, at least in the Charlotte region. Inventories are low, prices are high, developers have found available land in short supply and aren't building many new entry-level or mid-range homes, putting the squeeze on first-time home buyers. Construction costs are rising, and homeowners who in a different time might have considered selling are more reluctant to do so because they fear they might not find an appropriate place to live. It all adds up to a kind of gridlock for homes and home buyers and sellers. So what will it take for this tight market to loosen up? We hear about that this hour with Jason Gentry, president of the Charlotte Regional Realtor Association and realtor broker with Premier Sotheby's International. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Mike.
Good to see you. Rick Judson is a Charlotte residential developer and former chairman of the National Association of Home Builders. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Joe Padilla is executive director of the Real Estate and Building Industry Coalition. That's a trade organization for local builders, developers, and realtors. Thank you for being here, too. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can even watch us this morning on Facebook Live. Well, Jason, tight markets are usually good markets for home sellers, at least, because they can pretty much call the shots. But this market's so tight that, as I just mentioned, it's a problem because people aren't moving. They're afraid to move, and home sales have dipped as a result, I believe, you correct me if I'm wrong, for the fourth consecutive month this August.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's September looking like?
Probably more of the same. You know, this is kind of a trickle-down effect. It just keeps going. There's nothing that's really showing us good signs of new inventory that's increasing fast enough to keep up with the demand.
When's the last time you saw this?
It's been a long, long time since we've seen, you know, this much inventory being so short.
What's it doing to guys?
Unprecedented.
What's it doing to people in the real estate brokers and agents? What's it doing to them?
Well, we've got more brokers right now getting their license than ever. We're averaging about 100 per month. So, you know, I think there's this flurry of demand and everybody thinks real estate is the new hot thing to do. So we're not seeing it affect the people getting their license, that's for sure.
When real estate becomes the new hot thing to do, I get scared. It's like that's the bubble about to happen. I don't know if that's right or not, but it just seems to me that, that's what happens every time. Every market is about supply and demand. So how, Rick, would you describe the residential market at the moment? High demand, low demand, medium demand?
The analogy of supply-demand is perfect. That's the issue here. There's a demand for housing. At every single level, the pricing is a problem, certainly in the interlevel component, and the availability of product, particularly land, because it's gotten so expensive to develop, has exacerbated the problem. Mm-hmm. So you have an expensive lot, an expensive cost of housing because of tariffs and labor, number of factors there, and then you have a demand where the demand is greater than the supply.
Is the demand bigger than it used to be, or is the supply smaller than it used to be, or is it a combination?
Combination of the two. If you look at the demographics, we have more people coming into the purchasing stream than we have in the past. A lot of that's for a number of economic reasons resulting from the Great Recession, Depression, the millennials, just a lot of reasons that, that we have great demand. But when you couple that with fewer housing stock supply, you have, again, a perpetuating problem.
So if the demand is so high, Joe, why aren't developers, home builders, these big companies that build whole neighborhoods if they want to, why aren't they rushing in to fill the demand?
Well, they are. They would like to be. I think the issue is, as Rick mentioned, land. I mean, land is a limited resource. We only have so much of it. Mecklenburg County certainly is running out of land.
Really? Because I just drove down Albemarle Road yesterday for the first time in 10 years, and I thought, oh, my gosh.
Well, and part of what people don't realize, people do see land, and a lot of it, some of it's buildable, a lot of it is buildable, but there you don't just look at every piece of land out there and assume it can all accommodate houses.
Right.
You've got issues like topography. You have issues like you know, floodplain that limit usability of land. But the other thing we're seeing quite a bit of from the regulatory standpoint is you have, quite frankly, a lot of NIMBYism right now that is really constraining growth. And you have a lot of folks who are concerned about the impact that new homes and new development will have on their community and on their price and the value of their home. So they're pushing back. It's harder than it's been in a long time to get a zoning and to get development approved. So that's really slowing up supply.
So they're pushing back at zoning hearings?
At zoning hearings, primarily. I don't think there are very few zonings that will go through anywhere, not just in Mecklenburg County, but especially as you get further out into ex-urban counties. There's fear about schools being congested, roads being congested. And without the funding for infrastructure coming down the pipeline to really alleviate that, people are very worried about that impact.
So this NIMBYism, not in my backyard, ism.
Yep. Mike, I was at a zoning hearing last night until 10:30, and they had to shut it down because they didn't get to half of the petitions that were there. Now, part of that was the problem or result of the storm and the postponement from last week's meeting. But the point being, every zoning petition is being scrutinized more and more depth for a lot of reasons, whether it be the NIMBYism, whether it be the what's the economic impact, is it going to be more expensive than the neighbors, is it going to be less expensive.
Is this in Mecklenburg County or
this
all
was
the
Charlotte
county? Okay,
this was Charlotte zoning. The other counties are a little different. And
well, I was going to ask if this NIMBYism is pretty much taking place when it involves infill construction versus the wholesale buying of a farmland or forest land and putting a whole neighborhood on it?
I think both, honestly. Certainly infill has probably the likelihood that it's going to raise more opposition because it really does have an immediate impact on existing established neighborhoods. But we see it in every rezoning in counties, you know, all over the region, quite frankly. And you know, in the defense of people who are concerned about it, what they're worried about is, hey, you know, my school is overcrowded. It's taking me longer to get to work. That's an infrastructure issue. And we have to figure out as a region how to fund the infrastructure that's needed to accommodate our growth.
Home building prior to the Great Recession was, I mean, it was gangbusters. That you couldn't build a house fast. You couldn't build a neighborhood fast enough. And there were all these major nationwide companies or certainly big regional companies doing it. And there still are some out there that are doing this. But we're also seeing infill housing going into relatively stable older neighborhoods like Dilworth and Myers Park and places like that. Is that because people want to live closer in, or is that because builders can get more bang for their buck? There's a higher price point in those neighborhoods, and they can make more money as a result of building there as opposed to going out into the great far-flung suburbs.
I think it's absolutely both of those things. You know, I've got buyers right now that constantly they're telling me, I want to be close to the breweries, I want to be close to downtown, all the amenities and lifestyle products that offers them. But yeah, I think the builders are focusing on where they can capitalize the most. I mean, they're in business, right?
Right.
They want to
sure.
be the most effective making profit that they can. So I think it is both, absolutely.
Where are you selling? Of course, Premier Sotheby's is... you're a high-end real estate firm because you deal with higher-end real estate normally, but where are most agents, real estate companies, selling at the moment? Is it out in the suburbs? Is it the infill developments? Is it resale? Where are most of the sales coming from, do you know?
So we're seeing in our local market here in Charlotte and Mecklenburg County that sales are starting to dip, like you mentioned before. So we're seeing our outlying counties out past 485. That's where the increases in sales are actually occurring. So Gaston County, Leakin County, Cabarrus, you know, down in Fort Mill, Rock Hill, those
is that
areas
further
are
out
increasing.
Is that further out than it used to be prior to the recession?
Yeah, absolutely. We're seeing much more growth extend further and further out, and it's price point based, right?
Okay.
Folks are having to go search further to find the price point that they can afford. And, you know, we're seeing these communities develop as well. They offer more amenities now. They have the cute little downtowns and charming neighborhoods that people want to be a part of. So I think the fact that there's more amenities out there than there used to be, it's letting people make the decision to move further out.
And you've pointed out, Rick, that land costs and land availability is a key reason why home builders aren't filling the gap as quickly as they might if they could. And prior to the recession, it was my impression, at least from a layman's point of view, that old farms and fields and forest lands were being converted into neighborhoods just as fast as they could possibly do it. Have we run out of that land, or are the owners of that land more reluctant to sell it, or they want too much money for it because they know the demand is so high? What's happening in that area?
Some of all. The land prices in the what we'll call the suburban area, the farmland, mm-hmm. is more expensive now than it was, but it's also more difficult to get financing on large tracts of land, 100, 200 acres
Why?
Of land. Why is it?
Mm-hmm. More difficult to get.
Dodd-Frank, as a result of the recession depression, the legislation put hamstrings on real estate lending. The pendulum swung much too far. It has moved back to some degree of normality, but to the point you asked a moment ago, it's easier to do smaller infill projects mm-hmm. than it is a 200-acre farm that might last 7, 8, 9 years.
But if you're a Saucy Burbank, or I don't want to necessarily point out builders, or a Pulte, or an MI Homes, or any of those regional to large nationwide builders, that Dodd-Frank has affected you to that degree?
Yes.
Really?
I've developed lots for all of those that you just mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and it's a challenge. They are restrained by what they have on their balance sheets. They don't want to own the land. They want someone else to own the land. They buy the lots because it's a contingent liability for them if they buy the land and sit on it for 10 years. It's not good for their return on investment,
right.
which is a Wall Street component.
Right.
So they have the funding, but they have the funding because of the very scrutinous of their own balance sheet and financial statement.
So you say that when lot prices rise, obviously that adds to the price of a house, but it doesn't add to the square footage of the house, and people don't perceive that they're getting value for their money. And you cite regulatory stuff like mandating larger sidewalks or street trees and bike paths in neighborhoods where new builders are coming in and building. Isn't that being perceived by buyers as adding value? Maybe the house is still 1,800 square feet, and it may cost more than it did 5 years ago, but look, we got a bike path, we got a park, we got a pond.
There are two stratas to that. Mm-hmm. One would be exactly what you mentioned, where people want that amenity.
Mm-hmm.
They are willing to pay for that amenity. The other is our largest crisis in Charlotte, which is affordable housing. I met with planning last week on a 15-lot community that would be affordable housing. I promised the mayor I would do one personally. I'm a Charlottean.
Mm-hmm.
Promised I would do it.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you get through with the street trees, the new sidewalk, the impervious areas, and there's not a sidewalk in 2 miles of this property. And it's going to be nice new housing. But the person who's living under a bridge doesn't really care about architectural shingles and brick siding. They care about living in a warm, dry house.
So, and we've talked to the mayor about affordable housing, and the city has got this bond on the ballot in November for $50 million to put forward affordable housing, and the mayor has asked the faith community to step up with 50 more and the business community to step up with 50 more. So now we're talking about $150 million because they want developers on their own to supply, because they have no tools in their toolkit. They can't make you do this, to build affordable workforce housing. And what you're saying is that the regulations on the books make it cost prohibitive to supply it?
That's a very accurate
simplification. Do they know that? Do they understand that?
I think they're getting to that point. And the question is this a problem of the developer? So the developer adds cost to his lot mm-hmm. and passes it along to the builder, who then passes it along to the buyer. Or is it a community problem where we try to do some sort of tax-based subsidy with it?
I want to come back and ask you, if you built something that would be affordable to build without going through all the hoops that you have to jump through right now, what would that house be like? We'll get an answer to that when we come back at Charlotte Talks. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the state of real estate in Charlotte in a very tight market at the moment. Jason Gentry is a realtor broker with Premier Sotheby's and the president of the Charlotte Regional Realtor Association. Rick Judson is a residential developer and the former chairman of the National Association of Home Builders. And Joe Padilla is executive director of the Real Estate and Building Industry Coalition. So I was talking to Rick Judson just before the break about his attempt, at least, to build affordable housing at the request of the mayor, because you promised the mayor you would look into this and do it. And fundamentally, the restrictions or the requirements, let's put it that way, the requirements placed on builders make it somewhat unaffordable to build affordable housing, is what you're telling me. So if you were able to build the neighborhood that you can afford to build and make it affordable to people who need workforce housing, what would those homes, what would those neighborhoods be like?
The primary cost to start with would be the lot, the land. Now, do you need a 5-foot sidewalk and a 4-foot planting strip buffer and a bike path? Or do you just need a cut and grassed ditch that carries water off better than curb and gutter anyway, because you don't have the rush of water? I mean, this is somewhat of an engineering debate. But regardless, there would be less regulation on the land to the point that you could make the lot more affordable. Hence, the house that went on it will still cost the same thing to build that 1,500-square-foot house. But the percentage of the lot cost to the finished selling price would be less. And that's a huge, huge factor.
Would it affect the quality of the construction or simply the appearance of the house? Because architectural shingles, for people who don't know, are slightly different than builder grade. I guess just a straight shingle that you get that's a straight line shingle. Is there any difference in the quality or the long-lasting nature of that roof? Because if you're looking at affordable housing and it come and you're there 20 years from now when it's time to replace the roof, that's a big expense.
One's a 30-year shingle. It's called a 30-year shingle or a 40-year shingle. It's an architectural shingle. It's thicker asphalt and layered base.
Okay.
The normal shingle is called a 20-year shingle. So, yes, there's a quality difference. Everyone can afford something. The question is, do you impose a 40-year shingle on a person that can't afford a 20-year shingle?
Right. Joe, you're in the building business, and you represent the Building Industry Coalition. Are you hearing this from other builders, or is Rick an outlier?
No. No, Rick is
both.
Rick is certainly not an outlier. It is really very typical, and what I hear quite a bit from builders is they want to deliver. They know there's demand for price points that are $250,000, $200,000 below what we term in the industry workforce housing. The challenge is, as Rick mentioned, regulation. Studies will typically show that regulation contributes about 25% of the cost of a home is in that regulatory portion. And again, not every regulation is, I mean, most of the regulations are needed. Obviously, building code needs to be complied with. We need stormwater control so the property doesn't flood. We need, tree protection in some areas. The question is when those regulations start to move into an area where they become more of an amenity. It comes down to an issue of, as a community, we have to start to decide what's more important. And as Rick mentioned, I think he's absolutely right. It comes down to, do we want to provide housing for people who are trying to get in that first home, build equity, or do we want neighborhood amenities that, you know, may be important to us, but might not be as much of a priority for that first
home? But is it a fine line? If you have zoning ordinances that prescribe certain things that make the neighborhood more attractive, and you take those away to make the house more affordable, isn't it a fine line between building a house that somebody can get into at long last, as you say, to get them out from under a bridge? I think that might be a little slightly an exaggeration, but nonetheless, at long last in a house, versus building these neighborhoods that are literally slums in waiting. Give them 15 years.
Well, I mean, you know, there's a quality issue. When you talk about quality, you're talking about, in many cases, building code. Building code is not going to change from a $150,000 home to a $1.5 million home. The same building code applies. What we're talking about in a lot of cases are aesthetic requirements. And the biggest and most expensive aesthetic controls that are put on homes are things like brick, the exterior exterior cladding on the home can make a big difference from one to the other. Architectural design, if every home needs to have a front porch, that gets expensive. If every home needs to have a garage that's detached and set back, these look great. And certainly when people get to their third, fourth home, they become something that they really do seek and look for. But in that first home, very often they're trying, as Jason said earlier, to find something they can qualify for. And if they can't find it in Charlotte, in Mecklenburg County, then they're going to go increasingly further out. And that's going to cause all of us to have longer commute times and put pressure on infrastructure and so on.
Is it about building equity? I mean, you get in, build some equity, move up. Is that what it's about in your mind?
Absolutely. Home is the best savings account you can have, right? Because it's also providing you a tangible value. You can't beat that. There's nothing else that you can invest in that provides a roof over your head while growing equity.
So obviously people know that, which is why demand is high. So if demand is high, that's raising the price of houses right now. Interest rates are also rising.
Correct.
Which is the bigger factor to most buyers? Is it the fact that the house is $15,000, $20,000 more than they'd like it to be, or more than it was 6 months ago because of demand, or the fact that interest rates have gone up?
If you're the first-time home buyer, it's both of those. It compounds each other, right? So it's reducing the amount of home that you can afford in both directions. So your choices become less and less, and you push further and further outside the city to find what you're looking for. You don't want that drive time, but you don't have the choice.
So you've got those two factors, rising home prices, rising interest rates, and evidently building, the cost of building is rising and is liable to rise more if these tariffs take effect and sit and last there for a while. And that's pushed housing affordability, according to you, Jason, to a 10-year low. Put that into perspective. How much more expensive are houses right now than they were in 2008?
I'm not sure what the exact percentage is back to 2008, but I know, you know, we've got 30% less inventory than we had back then, right? And, you know, when prices go up as much as they've gone, I would say probably an average of about 5% per year, It's just making less and less options for people. And it doesn't matter what price point you're at. I've got a guy who's looking at a $900 to $1 million investment right now, and he can't find what he's looking for. So it really doesn't matter.
In terms of amenities or in terms of the house itself for the price?
Location is super important to him. He wants to be as close into the city as he can possibly be. And, you know, we did search radiuses around one house that he keeps going back to, but it's not the house that he really wants. He's just kind of sacrificing looking at this.
So if you're a homeowner owning an in-town home, a pretty close-in house and a pretty close-in neighborhood, and you've seen your home values rise, what good is that if nobody can afford it or is willing to pay that amount of money because it's not the right house for them? It may be in the right location, but it's not the right house. What good is that increased value?
Well, I think it's just the low inventory part of the equation. You know, if you only have three options and none of them really work for you, that fourth or fifth one might have, but it's not on the market. It's not an option.
Okay. The market, of course, is not a monolith. There must be segments of this market that are doing better than others in terms of buying and selling and prices, et cetera. What seems to be moving easily or more easily?
350,000 and below is what moves super fast and is probably going to have multiple offers on it. And
isn't that always the case?
Well, I mean, we're seeing the higher price stuff start to move faster because I think there's more of that inventory. So up at the lake, for example, we've got about 4 months of supply because our average sales price is higher up at the lake. Mm-hmm. You know, you're dealing with all these lakefront communities. So I think where you've got a little more inventory, now we're seeing buyers have more options. So they're starting to come to the table and move that market around more than it has traditionally.
So in the past, what was our average rate of inventory? How many months' worth of houses did we normally have?
Historically, we've talked about 6 months being a healthy market of supply where it's kind of at equilibrium. You've got enough supply for the buyers and the sellers to kind of equalize.
Right.
Right now, for our entire area, 16-county region, we're at less than three, right, probably around 2.2 months of supply, which is just unbelievably low.
Wow. So if there are certain house price points that are doing better than others, there are probably certain areas that are doing better than others. What are the hot areas now where things are actually selling?
So that's the outside 485. Our surrounding counties where we're seeing a lot of increased sales traffic, you know, we're up 5 to 10% depending on which county you're looking at. And we've never really seen that kind of growth in those areas before. So that's that lower price point that folks are pushing out further to get to achieve.
And yet it's the lower price point, the starter homes, evidently, that builders aren't too anxious to supply at the moment. The starter home and first time and the first move up, is that simply because of land costs?
Oh, I think they're very anxious to supply it. I think
Are they? Absolutely.
I think the issue is finding land that will accommodate it. And really more so than any one individual development regulation, what limits that is lot size and density. And when you go further out, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of these communities at the macro level are very worried about allowing density. They're worried about having, you know, smaller lots for a number of reasons. It may be infrastructure. It may be, we mentioned NIMBYism, which is a big impact. People don't want smaller homes on smaller lots. But the reality is, that's how you deliver a first-time product. You can't deliver a first-time home on a one-acre lot or even on a half-acre lot.
Is the shortage of first-time homes combined with the fact that people want to live closer in what's driving this apartment construction that's running rampant all over town?
Well, I think the apartment market is benefiting from a lot of folks who are, you know, getting into the workforce, starting out and in a position where they can't right now because of student loans, because of other debts, really put together that first-time down payment. And the reality is every survey we look at, every survey the National Association of Realtors does and the home builders do, will say the same thing. Most of these folks, you ask them eventually, do they want to own a home? And the answer is yes. It may be further out. It might be 10 years further out, but they do eventually want to own. So the concern that many of us in the industry have is we look at these apartments going up. We see folks moving in their 20s and their early 30s, and we know that at some point they're going to want single-family housing, and we're not delivering enough of a supply for them to really have those options when they're ready to buy.
Well, plus, if they want to move into closer-in locations, there won't be any land because it's all occupied by these five-story monolithic apartment buildings.
Well, and the reality is many of them are going to have to realize that for them to, if they've lived in South End or in Uptown in an apartment and they want to buy that first home, unless they're doing really, really well, yeah, it's going to be hard for them to afford a first-time home in Center City or close to.
And is that part of the problem from your point of view? I mean, if I really want to live close in and I'm young and I don't have a lot of money yet, or even if I've been in an apartment for 10 or 15 years and I've been socking it away, I still can't afford that house that I want here. I'll have to move out to Ballantyne or beyond the Beltway to do it. Is that keeping people from buying a home? Are you losing lots of prospects? Because, by gosh, I'm staying put. I'm staying close. I can go to the bar. I can go to the brewery. I can take the train, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, we worry that these folks are a little cash-strapped, right? And they might not be putting the savings away that they're going to need in the future to make that purchase. But we're also seeing a trend where this age group is going to the bank of mom and dad more than they ever have before. So there are options, and, you know, I work with these folks quite a lot, actually. And, you know, they're making $250,000, $350,000, $450,000 first purchases, which is pretty incredible.
Yes.
But, you know, they're waiting a little bit longer to do it.
So if you look at all the ads for these new apartments, one word is common among all of them. You know what it is?
Pet spa.
What?
Pet spa.
Well, that's a very particular part of luxury. Yeah. Luxury is the word I was looking for. And the same is true of housing. And Rebecca on Facebook writes, I'm tired of luxury everything. What happened to a nice starter home for under $200,000? Heck, what happened to one under $100,000? And most new houses in these developments look like they're made of drywall and silly putty. Let's talk about that. What are people looking for in a house? What does luxury mean? Granite countertop? Quartz countertop? What does it mean? It's all wallboard and flooring.
Mm-hmm. I think it's an aesthetic that we're seeing on, I call it the HGTV effect.
Yeah.
Everybody wants the sliding barn door. Well, that doesn't really cost that much than a regular door. It might be a little bit more expensive. But
why? It's a track. You don't even have to frame it.
It may be cheaper. I don't know, right? I mean, I think it's just this idea that it's something different. It's something that is maybe better than what was traditional,
yeah,
different than what was traditional.
Okay.
And it's given this luxury word a big go-around.
So when you're taking people around and they want, and maybe they don't use the word luxury when they come to you and say, here's what I'm looking for. But if they do, what is that? What does that mean?
I think it's different to different people, okay. Right? I mean, it could be hardwoods throughout the house, but there's different grades of hardwood, right?
Right.
So I think it's ultimately what luxury means to that particular buyer.
Okay.
You know, so Jason makes a good point with that. Each person at his own price point makes a determination to what is luxury. Mm-hmm. And what is the trade-off between what I can afford and what I would like. We all do that.
So if you're living in a quote-unquote luxury apartment uptown and you've decided to make the move to a house, and what you can afford is what we call a starter home, mm-hmm. which may be labeled luxury, is the luxury going to be comparable? Or if it's not labeled luxury and you're moving from a luxury apartment, are you going to feel like you're moving down?
They won't find the same luxury in a single-family home for the same price that they did in that apartment.
So what are they going to be missing? Seriously, the island, the kitchen island, what are they going to be missing?
Well, just to give a simple example, let's say you put 100 apartment units on 3 acres of land. You're not going to put 100 single-family homes
right.
on 3 acres of land. So you start amortizing the cost of that land
okay.
over a single-family house, and now you've quadrupled
the
cost of that lot.
I think the driver, too, Mike, is going to be where they are in their lifestyle. When you're single, you're young, you know, you don't have a family and you're not having kids, those trade-offs are a little easier to make. I think what we'll see is when many of these people start to want a family and start to have a family, they'll say, you know what, I mean, I'm looking for whatever home buyer, and Jason knows this very well, schools. They want value for their dollar. They want to be in a community where their kids can ride in the street and they can feel safe. And I think all of those things are going to outweigh in many cases that, hey, I want to be down the street from a brewery. Mm-hmm. So it really is a lifestyle. And we're seeing a lot of people coming into the city now who haven't quite hit that stage of their life. But at some point they will, and the market is going to adjust, I think, to accommodate what they're looking for.
You say, Joe, that the surrounding jurisdictions, Union County, York County, et cetera, are also making it difficult to deliver first-time or lower-income housing. How so?
Well, again, a lot of it comes back to their zoning districts and the inability to build homes on smaller lots. But a lot of it, and we saw it in York County, rather, 3 months ago, the adoption of a $15,000 impact fee on new home construction. There are regulatory costs that are going in. More than anything, though, what people don't equate to it is the lack of ability to put homes on smaller lots and have that density that creates a more walkable smaller lot community where you can get those prices.
So you're saying that these outlying areas don't want the density. They want bigger yards. And the impact fees go to what, water, sewer, schools?
It depends. In York County, yeah, they go mainly, most of the new impact fee is for schools. They also go to parks. They can go to public safety. There are a lot of different categories they can be imposed on in South Carolina.
I want to talk about, when we come back, some of the things that home builders face today in terms of requirements and restrictions that they didn't face prior to the recession or 20 years ago. We'll come back and talk about that in a moment, and many other things as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the state of real estate in Charlotte in a very tight market with rising home costs, rising interest rates, rising building costs, increasing regulation for home builders, decreasing amount of land available out there, which is not a recipe for a tasty stew. Let's put it that way. Jason Gentry is a realtor broker for Premier Sotheby's International and also the president of the Charlotte Regional Realtor Association. Rick Judson is residential developer, former chairman of the National Association of Home Builders, and Joe Patilla is with us. He's executive director of Real Estate and Building Industry Coalition. What are some of the requirements or requests or restrictions that home builders and developers face today that they didn't face either just before the recession hit or 15, 20 years ago that are making things as tight as they are today, Rick?
The National Home Builders does a study every quarter on what its members, which is 250,000 member companies. So it's a pretty broad and accurate section of what they view the problems to be. And they are typically falling into three categories. And the top three now are labor, land, and construction costs. And those will vary from quarter to quarter, year to year, based on the tariff, the issue du jour, the the immigration policies relating to labor, the changing age range of skilled labor forces, many, many factors, but primarily those three components.
Because you've said that compared to building houses here in the early days, the costs today, if complying with regulations, would double the price of any entry-level home. There is no such thing as a $100,000 house anymore. So define early days and tell me what's adding, doubling the price.
Prior to the recession, I was probably building 100 houses a year at or around $100,000.
Okay.
Lots cost almost $100,000 these days.
So the price of the house isn't going up, all the construction costs are.
The cost of the house is going up, but proportionately it's the land. Joe mentioned earlier about codes. Codes was originally designed as a health and safety issue. That's the jurisdiction. When you require some of the things that are being required now for development and for code issues, it pushes the price point tighter and tighter and tighter so that that entry-level product is no longer affordable.
And this has all happened since 2008, since the recession? Is that what's doing it?
It has crescendoed since then, yes.
Huh. Because it was my impression years ago, before the recession, that home builders could not build houses fast enough, and they were building them as fast as they could. I mean, the holdup was being able to book a moving van. Mm-hmm. That was the holdup.
Yeah.
Is it simply Dodd-Frank? Is it simply rising costs of land, et cetera, that slowed all that down once the recession went away?
If you look back, it's an interesting phenomenon. If you look back at the buyer today who was a teenager in the recession depression,
mm-hmm.
they saw their parents' house get foreclosed upon. People were paying too much for housing. They couldn't afford it. Banks would loan anything to anybody if they could fog a mirror. Point nowadays are you're being very scrutinized for lending. It's hard to qualify a buyer. It's equally hard to find a house that's in the affordable range.
Yeah.
So these people that grew up in that scary time of seeing their parents and housing being maybe not such a good thing, they're the buyers that are renting.
Well, is it a good thing? I mean, Jason, you said a minute ago that's the best bank account you can have, your house, and I'm wondering if that's really true. I mean, it's a good talking point for real estate, but is it really true? I mean, somebody did a study of Amsterdam and that famous strip of homes that everybody sees in the postcards of Amsterdam. And if you go back to the time that they were built, which was just beyond medieval times, to today, and you adjust for inflation, they haven't increased in value at all. And you can barely afford to get into them. I mean, you have to be really wealthy to get into them, actually. So is it really an investment?
Absolutely.
People viewed it as a piggy bank before the recession. Is it that?
I think you have to weigh the fact that, you know, you can throw money at renting and never get that money back, or you can invest that money into a home, into a savings account, and get it back. And it keeps growing in
but
value.
But can you? I mean, if you overbuild for the neighborhood, you're not going to get that investment back. You have to be smart about it, right?
You do have to. That's why you need to hire a realtor.
Yeah, but once you're in, if you decide, well, I'm going to updo the kitchen, or I'm going to add a fourth bathroom, or I'm going to do this, or I'm going to do that, you could be overbuilding for the neighborhood. And
therefore,
you put all this $100,000 into the house, and you're not going to get $100,000.
Mike, that's a function of that person's judgment on what they want. That's not a function of the real estate
component. Of course not.
If you buy the house, which is clearly the person's largest investment and their opportunity for net worth growth, period. And I would argue with anyone about that. Obviously, if you go in and put slate shingles on a house that's a $200,000 house, you're probably not going to get that money back.
Mm-hmm.
But the point being, the house itself is a great investment.
So are these factors that are keeping people out of first-time homes affecting people at the 500,000, 800,000, million-plus level of home buying as well?
Yes, because inventory is less in all of those price points across the board.
Okay. Jennifer emails, we live in the Windsor Park neighborhood in East Charlotte. As houses in our neighborhood are flipped, folks are painting brick houses. Why do people paint brick? And always white or pale gray. By the way, we've been in the neighborhood for 13 years. Our house has almost paid off, whoa, and is now worth double what we paid for it, but we won't ever paint it. This is a decorative question. It's an aesthetic question, but one of the features of a brick house is you don't have to paint it. Have you ever tried to paint a house? If you hire a painter to paint a house, that's a fortune. Why would people do that?
HGTV.
the aesthetics, you know, we talked about that earlier. It's the aesthetics.
It's a trend. You know, I think to your point, though, you can have a brick house that you don't have to paint every 15, 20 years. Now, the good thing about brick is it absorbs paint well, so you're not painting it every 5 years, right? But you are adding costs to achieve that look that you want.
Teresa on Facebook says, I live in Monroe. They're changing it even as I read it. I live in Monroe. It seems like Monroe could be a good option for folks if so much of the existing stock weren't low-quality rentals. Do buyers show interest in older homes anymore, or is the demand all for new construction?
I have this really complicated problem where I take buyers out and show them a house that they could change the brass out on and pop in granite countertops. The issue is they don't want to do the work. They want to move in ready and just bring their couch and their bed and they're done.
Well, then, so in this market, if you're representing a seller and you know that about their house, they have gold fixtures in the bathroom and they have Corian countertops, are you advising them to replace those before they put it on the market? Or is it better to leave that stuff in place and let the new buyer do it the way they want it? Because they may not like what you did when you fixed it up.
Everything is hyper-local, but pretty much across the board, if that seller is willing to do that work, the difference it's going to make is they're going to get that offer faster, which means they're going to get more money. They're not going to have to do a price reduction. Mm-hmm. It just increases the chance that they're going to get what they want for the property. So if you can do that work, absolutely do it.
Okay. The president, and we've talked a little bit about, we've touched on this, is raising tariffs on some materials, especially those coming from China. How will this, and or is this, impacting builders right now?
It's impacting, obviously, material costs. It started with Canadian softwood lumber. And that was last year's issue, and it's going to continue to work its way through. Lumber, obviously, is probably the biggest component.
Right.
You know, the other thing that people don't talk about, in addition to materials going up, is labor. And labor, Rick mentioned earlier, is a huge component. And one of the challenges we're having in the market, in the industry, is very few people are going into the construction trade. And very few people are looking at what are excellent, very well-paying careers in the construction field.
Are you talking about the people who actually cut the wood and hammer the nails, or are you talking about different levels of construction trade?
Really both. I mean, quite frankly, a lot of where we see the demand right now is in the specialty trades. If it's on the commercial side, you're talking about folks doing welding. On the residential side, it would be tile, people who do tile, people who do hardwood, people who do all of the specialty work.
And why are they disappearing?
Yeah, a lot of it is, and we can go back and look back at the downturn, the Great Recession, that drove a lot of people out. People at that point realized that, well, you know, it was a good career for a little while, and then it disappeared, and I'm not going to continue to pursue a career that is mercurial in nature. So they've left, and a lot of people are not coming in. A lot of these are also family companies, and they are not bringing in. For whatever reason, their kids aren't finding the appeal of that trade way that maybe their parents did.
I was an architect before the recession.
You were?
To that point, though, what Joe's saying is, right, that field was the highest unemployment rate of any field in the country because of the recession. I'm not going to go back to it.
Wow. So what about the other aspect of this that we really haven't talked about? And you talk about the shortage of personnel in the building industry. Prior to the recession, if you drove through any of these neighborhoods that were being built en masse, they were all immigrant labor.
Yeah.
Hispanic workers, many of whom were probably undocumented.
Mm-hmm.
Now that ICE is cracking down on all this, is that exacerbating the problem? Is it impossible to find workers to build these homes?
I think the bigger problem, quite frankly, is, you know, what I just mentioned, people who came into the United States for work back during the downturn and saw that work disappear, many of them went back to their home country and have not come back because they've realized that, you know, the opportunity to make the living they were making vanished. when things just kind of went up in smoke back in the the early 2000s, 2008, 2007. And so they have left, and they're not returning. So that labor force has gone away by attrition.
So are builders being forced to pay higher prices for the people working on these homes?
Absolutely. Yep. I happen to chair the National Housing Endowment in Washington, which is the philanthropic arm for the National Association of Home Builders. Mm-hmm. There are two silos there, the skilled trades and the managerial. And the pendulum has really swung to a problem in the skilled trades, both aging out and the fact that the younger workers are not willing to go into that because of what they experienced 7, 8, 9 years ago with the recession. And let's face it, much of it is immigrant, and they cannot qualify through E-Verify for employment.
Right.
So the fact of the matter is what is available from a labor standpoint is charging more money.
So President Trump, a Republican, and Republicans are generally more favorable to business perhaps than Democrats are. President Trump has struck, has really come down, has had his Immigration and Naturalization Service really crack down on immigration. He's also waging this tariff war kind of with China and other countries. Does he know, has your business transmitted to the Trump administration the impact this is and will continue to have?
Trump is a builder.
Yes.
He grew up as
the developer.
A builder.
Yes.
I've spoken with him personally
twice,
and he reiterated the fact that I'm a builder.
Okay.
I grew up in your industry.
Okay.
And without being trite, you'd say, well, are you seeing what the impact of some of these regulations is doing to our industry? I think we've been abused so long from the tariff trade imbalance. And I'm not trying to defend Trump, but I think he has said, let's draw a line in the sand. Let's be fair about this. Now, when it levels up, I don't know. But to your question to Joe a moment ago, cost of framing in a house is up
$7,000.
$7,000. That's a lot of money.
So will he understand this when it hits the construction of Trump hotels, or will he understand it because somebody will knock on the door and say, hey, Mr.
He hears
President.
It right now. He hears it from our industry. I think he hears it from the general industry, but certainly from the home building industry. The tariffs is an impact, is a huge impact.
Zoning codes are also a huge impact for local builders, and the city has been working on developing this unified, what do they call it, Unified Development Code, which is kind of difficult to understand. They've even changed the name, but I think they've changed their focus on that now. But nonetheless, they're trying to make it more transparent, less opaque for builders, so the builders, there's less uncertainty in the equation. Is that working? Do you have hope that when they're done with it, that it will make it easier for you to plan?
I do. We've worked very closely with the city. I know you had Taiwo Shawoba on the show last week.
Right.
He has done a tremendous job. Marcus Jones, I think, has really, and the mayor, I give the mayor a tremendous amount of credit, as well as many members of council. They get it. They understand that we have building codes, building development regulations, really, that are antiquated, mm-hmm. that trip over one another, that conflict. And there has been a very concerted effort to streamline, because you're absolutely right. If we can get the process to the point where it is more streamlined, where developers don't have to continue to go back for clarification on different regulations, or this regulation says this, something else says something else, I've got to figure out what to do and how to comply, then the time process, the time factor is reduced greatly. And then if you can do that, you reduce cost of development as well. So we're very optimistic it's going to help.
Mike, I would say in this meeting I attended last night with the council meeting, mm-hmm. to a person, every single case that was brought up, the council, someone on the council represented and recognized the fact that we are a little archaic in some of our laws and regulations, and we need to modify those. This might or may not be a good project, but it doesn't fit the square peg in the round hole kind of thing.
I have 30 seconds left, and I have a question I'm going to email. I'm going to truncate from Mike about square footage. Everybody wants a big house. Wouldn't it be better if they bought a smaller house with better architectural features? Would that be more cost effective to build a smaller house but make it just great inside? It
doesn't affect the cost of the lot at all. Doesn't affect the regulations.
We're back to the aesthetics.
What that person wants.
And very quickly, 5 seconds, outlook for the next 6 months.
It's not changing.
Not changing. You heard it from Jason Gentry with Premier Sotheby's International and the president of the Realtor Broker of the Charlotte Regional Realtors Association, Rick Judson, former chairman of the National Association of Home Builders, and Joe Padilla, the executive director of Real Estate and Building Industry Coalition. Thank you all. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.